that is taking place within China's borders. In the aftermath of Tiananmen, at the height of American leverage over global affairs, George H.W. Bush moved quickly to make amends with the Chinese Communist Party, and Bill Clinton followed suit, welcoming China into the World Trade Organization and the lucrative club of nations that agree upon a set of rules for international trade, even though China routinely broke them. I understand the motivation. From the standpoint of the ordinary American, the Chinese market has been a limitless frontier, a place where cheap goods could be manufactured to lower costs for American consumers. And as China developed, Chinese consumers could support American jobs by buying more of our stuff. The economy that I've lived in most of my life is shaped by this dynamic. American manufacturing jobs were displaced to China. Cheaper goods facilitated bargain shopping that started at places like Target and Walmart and migrated to Amazon. Electronics emerged from supply chains designed as intricately as your smartphone. Ideas from Silicon Valley and chips made in America to be assembled in China and sold back to Americans. Things worked out very well for the people at the top, and everyone else owed the illusion of rising standards of living to a basic bargain. The cost of education and healthcare and housing kept going up, but at least you could buy cheap household goods, drive a big car, and entertain yourself on a phone that offered the promise, or distraction, of infinite immersion. Meanwhile, the rich people who could own stocks and trade in markets got wealthier and translated that wealth into political, social, and cultural influence. Obama governed in line with this consensus, even if he was at the progressive end of it. He was consumed by the need to rescue the global economy and find some way to resume economic growth. Those priorities depended upon Chinese spending and stability, a machinery of economic growth that, like America's sprawling banks, had become too big to fail. But over the 30 years since Tiananmen, the balance of influence between America and China has also shifted, almost imperceptibly, like a picture that changes as it comes into sharper focus. Now, as China surpasses the United States as a source of influence in an increasing number of sectors and regions, it is not surprising to see more aggressive efforts to shape the behaviors of U.S. companies and their employees. In the fall of 2019, I got a call from the Houston Rockets general manager, Daryl Morey, who had gotten himself into hot water for tweeting in support of Hong Kong protests against the heavy hand of China's rule. Stand for freedom, support Hong Kong. Twitter is banned in China, so the Chinese government clearly had to choose to make the tweet a story in China and manufacture a sense of nationalist outrage to send a warning shot across the bow of the NBA and any other American company with interests in China. State media was whipped into an anti-NBA frenzy. NBA games were yanked off Chinese television. Lucrative shoe contracts for American athletes were suspended. Billions of dollars were at risk. The Chinese insisted that Morey be fired or disciplined, something that Adam Silver, the NBA commissioner, refused to do. Morey is a smart and innovative man. He repurposed the data-driven Moneyball approach that reshaped baseball and used it to assemble successful Rockets teams. But when he called me in the thick of the controversy, he was shocked by his entry into geopolitics. Pacing on a nondescript side street of Los Angeles, outside a coffee shop where I was working on this book, I explained to him that the Chinese will always test the limits of how much they can control your actions. That's what they were now doing, testing the NBA. I explained that if there weren't established lines that couldn't be crossed, in this case, China policing the speech of NBA executives, players, and even fans, then they would keep pushing. The Rockets were particularly important to China because Yao Ming, the greatest Chinese basketball player of all time, had been a Rocket and now ran China's Basketball Association. It was, in miniature, what had happened between our two countries. The Rockets had made Yao a global figure in the same way that America had helped make China an economic juggernaut. Now China was using its newfound leverage to control what the Rockets could do and say, in much the same way that they try to leverage America across the board. How many American companies have bent to China's will, restricting the speech of their own employees, making compromise after compromise to avoid offending an authoritarian government? How many powerful Americans had abandoned support for causes like the Dalai Lama's effort to preserve Tibetan identity, because they didn't want to get a knock on their hotel room door in the middle of the night or lose access to the Chinese market. Mori's job had been spared, but he had also deleted the tweet, and the team's star player, James Harden, had apologized. After the Mori incident, I started to notice things around me that had been a less visible presence before. When my daughter watched a hit Disney movie, for instance, a map of China included its absurd maritime border, a dotted line swallowing up the entire South China Sea. How often does the map of a country indicate its maritime border? The blockbuster movies that sustain Hollywood's bottom line now depend upon Chinese moviegoers even more than American ones. Every film that is released in China is vetted by the Central Propaganda Department. A Chinese company, Wanda, owns the second largest American movie theater chain. And while it's easy to find major American films that are critical of the American government, try to find a blockbuster movie that takes on the Chinese Communist Party. Instead, American blockbusters are now laced at times with subplots of Chinese ingenuity helping to fend off alien invasions or to rescue Sandra Bullock from space. More subtly, they're devoid of the admittedly simplistic Cold War storylines that I grew up with, when the good guys were fighting for democracy and the bad guys were totalitarian oppressors. It's easier instead to have the bad guys be people who don't control a chunk of the global market. Muslim terrorists, for instance, a representation that can justify both America's war on terror and China's repression in Xinjiang. In this way, American companies, banks, entertainment conglomerates, sports leagues, and even the U.S. government are operating under the same social credit system that applies to Chinese citizens. The incentives and disincentives are clear. Using the leverage of money within the system of American-designed global capitalism, the Chinese Communist Party is increasingly shaping our choices and incrementally exerting control over what we say and think. "Nobody took the Chinese nation seriously," Bao Pu said to me. "It's a poor country. They're never going to get themselves organized." Unspoken was the implicit bias that likely led many Americans to think a non-white nation could never surpass us in influence. The internet broke the national border for information, but the party has created its own border, Bao Pu continued. "Of course the internet and globalization complicate things. People in the West all of a sudden feel vulnerable, and there are people out there with a willful intention to use that against you." How extraordinary that in my own relatively short lifespan, the internet and globalization have become more of a threat to the democracies that set them in motion than to totalitarian regimes like China's. Bao Pu is unsparing in his assessment of where this is going. "The Communist Party of China is a cancer to humanity," he told me. He saw little hope emanating from China, including its educated ranks. "The Chinese intellectuals are doing nothing but building the Chinese identity, their own project to make China great again." But I sensed a continued internal conflict within Bao Pu. He preferred democracy, but was uncomfortable oversimplifying what has happened in an enormous and ancient country like China. He recognized the achievement of the party, but thought they had stumbled into their current position by being in control at the right time. He opposed identity politics, but was plainly proud of his Chinese identity. He rejected the grievance-filled nationalism of the party, but he clearly harbored some of the same grievances. And despite his belief that Tiananmen was an accident of history, doomed to fail, Bao Pu had spent much of his life trying to fight against this whitewashing. I asked him why the party had to whitewash Tiananmen from history. "Because they can," he answered, echoing my own sense of why Putin had poisoned Navalny. "It's just because they can. The Tiananmen student protest exemplified nonviolent struggle. But because nonviolence was met with tanks and machine guns, right and wrong was really clear. The Communist Party had no excuse for this massacre, even within their own rhetoric. The history of the Communist Party is littered with inconvenient truths. Cultural Revolution, they can't explain. The Great Famine, they can't explain. They had to erase them all from history." In recent years, Bao Pu's publishing business has suffered. He used to sell books largely to mainland Chinese, who would come to Hong Kong and take them back home. Then, in 2014, the Chinese government abducted several Hong Kong booksellers, detained them in China, and in one case, forced a man to make a videotaped confession of all his trumped-up wrongdoing. Meanwhile, the Chinese government bought out the vast majority of booksellers in Hong Kong, with the result that there is less space for the kind of provocative books that Bao has published. For those who still buy them, there are much more intrusive checks at mainland Chinese ports of entry. For a party that has such control over the information environment inside China, the measures may seem extreme, but that's exactly the point. If even bringing a book inside the country is dangerous, then starting a mass nonviolent movement becomes nearly impossible. For his part, Bao Pu told me he is shifting from nonfiction to fiction. The battle to shape perceptions of recent history and objective reality has become increasingly impossible to fight. There are other ways to shape hearts and minds besides using nonfiction, he told me. I think the people in the 21st century receive information from either education or entertainment. Perhaps entertainment would be a better tool. Bao Pu did volunteer an explanation for the seeming tension within some of his own comments. Given the totality of that system, he said of China, people like me spent 30 years to basically reassess what I learned in the first 20 years of my life in China. And I still sometimes come to a realization that I'm programmed to think a certain way. The Communist Party is operating in an Orwellian way. It rewrites history. It monopolizes information and therefore controls people's minds. China's Communist Party has spent the 30 years since Tiananmen reprogramming the minds of its people, blending the aspiration for material wealth with a national identity rooted in past grievances and manifest destiny, to trade the Western ideal of Marxism for a version of authoritarian capitalism. This project can be stifling to the individual, which is why Bao Pu resisted it. I personally make those who change history, who rewrite history, my enemy, because their willful social engineering is suffocating the creativity of the population. When you wrap your mind around the scale of the challenge to individual liberty posed by the Chinese Communist Party, it's easy to succumb to a sense of inevitability about the dystopia that lies ahead. But then, I remind myself that people were equally certain, back in 1989, that the future would evolve in a particular direction, that America was ascendant, and its model of democracy and open markets would inevitably prevail. Who could have foreseen, back then, what events like the Iraq War and the financial crisis and the election of Donald Trump would bring about? In assessing the present, what you cannot account for is the intrusion of hubris and history. The inevitable overreach of a totalitarian government and the irreducible longing of human beings to live without a boot on their throat. The event that might spark some form of mass mobilization, which, in retrospect, always seems inevitable. When I asked Maya Wang about the party's hijacking of Chinese identity, she pushed back. To Maya, the absence of space for free and open discourse concealed the diversity of the people. People in China are not one-dimensional, she told me. The problem is we have no open space, no place to openly debate issues and hold different views. So there are alternative Chinese identities that are different from the interests of the party. Like Shandor, she was pointing to those more local, community-based forms of belonging and meaning. Like Navalny, she was holding out a space for a form of nationalism that is not destined to serve a particular national power structure. Like Bao Pu, she believed it was wrong to see being Chinese as something that cannot be distinct from the party. People rightly feel defensive about their country. However much nationalism does play a role in politics, people who talk to each other about issues in China, their gears shift. What happens may not take the form of dissent, but it suggests that the party's rigid framework does not define the people. She gave me an example. One of her older relatives went back to China. He knows his friends very well, she told me, and they were all telling him that the Hong Kong protests are a Hong Kong independence movement, which is very much the party line, that everyone from peaceful protesters to Daryl Morey are trying to dismember the Chinese nation. Who do you hear that from? Her relative asked. It's not about independence. It's people fighting for their rights. When the group pushed back, he asked them, why do you trust the party? When they say this about revolutionaries, who were smeared and then rehabilitated after the Cultural Revolution. All of these people, after all, had lived to see the party's version of the truth change over time. In the same way that Winston Smith, the protagonist in 1984, came to distrust everything the party told him because his own memory recalled a time when history was different. Maya estimated that the 10 people in this group held views that could be matched in the diversity of gatherings of similar size in rooms across China. There would be two or three people gung-ho for nationalism, she said. Then you have three or four people who say, you are right, we want democracy, but I'm too afraid. Or, we can't get there. Or, China would be too chaotic. And then you'll have two people who are liberal, progressive. Right now, the prevailing circumstances push those three or four people in the direction of the party, as they are products of decades of education, propaganda, economic policies, suppression, and surveillance. The question is whether those circumstances can change, and when. 18. One country, two systems. I felt an affinity for Hong Kong from my first visit in 2002. With steep mountains ringing a majestic harbor lined with skyscrapers, it had a geography that changed the way I looked at the possibility of a physical space, a futuristic city implanted on an improbable landscape. As a British colonial outpost, Chinese city, and global center of finance, it gave off, street by street, a sense of being a bridge or portal between worlds, East and West, communism and capitalism, open and closed societies. Here, one could imagine, there had been all manner of intrigue over the decades. Opium traders, dissidents escaped from mainland China and the spies looking for them, foreign correspondents and organized crime, Chinese tycoons and Westerners who'd never lived in the West. During that first visit, I was 25 years old, and Hong Kong was only 5 years removed from British rule. From the window of my hotel, I could make out the old English building that housed colonial government offices amid narrow streets marked by traditional Chinese characters. I rode a ferry from central Hong Kong across the harbor to Kowloon, a breeze in my face, looking back at the skyline, the tallest buildings not reaching the height of the houses that dotted the mountaintop behind them. As a New Yorker, I'm vulnerable to falling in love with great cities, and I remember in that moment thinking that the world held an infinite number of discoveries to be made, mysteries to solve. For perhaps the last time in my life, I had no idea what my future held. I didn't return to Hong Kong until March 2017. It was my first introduction to the kind of speaking that people do when they leave government. In this case, sitting in a conference room in one of those high-rise buildings along the harbor, with video links to offices in other Asian capitals, talking to a slice of a bank's workforce about social media strategy and global trends. I had never before considered the subjects I was talking about from the perspective of making a profit, and I was struck by how obviously that shifted your perspective. Up above the city, you no longer felt you were in a nation-state. Instead, you were in the globalized community of capital markets. Men and women of different nationalities looking for some germ of knowledge that could allow them to make a bet on something. Currencies, companies, geopolitical risk that would pay off. The latest technologies were readily available. The video links more pristine than those that used to connect me with a global community of diplomats and military officers from the White House Situation Room. There was a seemingly limitless supply of bottled water, coffee, and tea. I had the peculiar feeling of being a commodity. In the world of finance, my accumulated knowledge and experience could be plugged into this world of markets, the trillions of transactions that shoot across computer screens every day. The world of politics dealt with the people on the other end of those transactions. One country, two systems. That was the promise made to the people of Hong Kong when they were passed to Chinese sovereignty in 1997. the handover had been negotiated between the British and the Chinese, largely excluding Hong Kongers. And there were a number of contradictions. Hong Kong was a part of China, but had not been governed by Beijing for a century. People in mainland China spoke Mandarin, while the people of Hong Kong spoke Cantonese. Hong Kong was a liberal open society. Mainland China was ruled by the Communist Party. One country, two systems was meant to reconcile those differences, or at least allow them to coexist. Hong Kong would become a part of China, but it would be entitled to its own laws, democratic practices, and civil liberties. This arrangement was to stay in place until 2047, a date that must have seemed impossibly far away when the handover ceremony took place on June 30, 1997. A band played "God Save the Queen" as the Union Jack was lowered one last time just before midnight. After a 12-second pause, a tiny window of suspended sovereignty, the flag of the People's Republic of China was raised to the tune of the March of the Volunteers, the Chinese national anthem. "With our flesh and blood, let's build a new Great Wall." As Prince Charles sailed away aboard the royal yacht, accompanied by the last British governor of Hong Kong, the belief among many liberals in Hong Kong and the West was that China would become more like Hong Kong than the other way around. That was wrong. Over the next two decades, China became more nationalist, more authoritarian, and more of a presence in the lives of Hong Kongers. In 2019, the people rose up, beginning with a series of protests against legislation that would allow mainland fugitives in Hong Kong to be extradited to China. Massive demonstrations filled the city and morphed into a nimble movement of flash protests, sit-ins at the airport and universities, encrypted mobilization, and cultural memes. The stakes were higher than just the politics of Hong Kong. The growing luster of the Chinese Communist Party's model depends upon the proposition that people prefer order and prosperity to the dysfunction and chaos exemplified by American democracy. Give the people economic growth, a nationalist story of ascent to believe in, and the cultural products of a liberal society, American-made superhero movies, and opinionless athletes, and they will be happy. So Hong Kong was an uncomfortable twist in the plotline of Chinese ascendancy. There was only one place in the world where people lived under a blend of China's system and the characteristics of an open society. If the Communist Party's model was superior, presumably the people of Hong Kong would want to opt into it. But throughout 2019, people had been making clear through protests that involved an enormous share of the Hong Kong population that they did not want that. I traveled to Hong Kong that November to understand why. I considered leaving my electronics at home. "Bring a burner phone and a Chromebook instead," my friend said. But out of a mixture of laziness, how does one set up these other electronics? And fatalism, the Chinese are probably already in my stuff. I made no such adjustments. And so, as I trundled off the 17-hour flight into the bright duty-free lights of the airport, my devices caught the available network and presumably fell within the reach of China's monitors, whoever or whatever they are. For all I know, they are reading these lines as I type. It was nearly midnight by the time I was dropped off in front of my hotel in central Hong Kong. The same one, in fact, that I had stayed at back in 2002. The street was quiet, empty of people or cars. But the question of Hong Kong's identity and whether it could be separate from China's was clearly very much in play. The city was uncharacteristically covered in graffiti. On the wall across from the hotel, painted letters were illuminated in the ghostly half-light of the street lamps. "Free Hong Kong. Fuck the Popo. If we burn, you burn with us." In the morning, I walked to one of Hong Kong's cavernous shopping malls, where I met Wilson Lung, a spokesperson for an organization called the Progressive Lawyers Group, a collective of several hundred Hong Kong lawyers who provide legal analysis and support for the protest movement. It must be noted that my conversations with Wilson took place before a new national security law was passed that ambiguously criminalizes conversations with foreigners that could be deemed subversive. More on that later. We met for breakfast in a buffet room that allowed you to pile Chinese and Western staples together. Think dim sum and scrambled eggs on the same plate. Wilson had been a student at the time of the 1997 handover, a time that he remembers as hopeful. The first decade of Chinese rule was a period of relative calm, without much interference. We carried on with the annual Tiananmen vigil. You could say mostly what you wanted. There was still active press on both sides. But there were signs of unease in the population, a fear of Chinese authority that was just under the surface. In 2003, when the Hong Kong government tried to pass a national security law that would have encroached on Hong Kong's civil liberties, 500,000 people demonstrated. Otherwise, demonstrations on behalf of a more democratic system were carried on by a relatively small activist cohort. As Chinese rule entered its second decade, Beijing's efforts to assert control over Hong Kong began to accelerate in ways that were imperceptible day to day, but transformative over time. The way that the Chinese government does these things, Wilson explained, is really through a whole-of-society approach. Businesses that relied on the Chinese market were told that their employees should not express political views. Mainland Chinese tycoons with ties to the government began to buy up nearly all the major newspapers and television stations and toe a reliably pro-Communist Party line. Independent media were denied a license to operate. Certain kinds of speech began to disappear, not because any one dictate went out, but simply because they began to be regarded as outside the realm of accepted discourse. Life became less free. Even as these changes were taking place, the relative prosperity and the feeling of openness remained. No Berlin Wall went up. No troops were in the streets. What's so interesting, Wilson said, is that life is basically similar, right? Wilson told me that the changes in the society accelerated around the time Xi Jinping came to power in 2013. Control from Beijing became tighter. There were more restrictions on what you could say, what kinds of media were available, what kinds of events were permitted. In advance of Hong Kong's 2014 elections, there was a debate about how Hong Kong would select its chief executive, the top official in the government. Many Hong Kongers preferred a free and direct election of the chief executive in line with the democracy they'd been promised. But Beijing tossed those proposals out. Hong Kongers would be offered a choice among a very small number of candidates who'd been pre-screened by Beijing. This decision triggered what became known as Occupy Central, or the Umbrella Movement. Tens of thousands of Hong Kongers inspired by the Occupy Wall Street movement occupied part of the city's center for several months. Another indication that American influence comes not just from what our government is doing, but also from our people. The eyes of the world were on Hong Kong's politics. Business was disrupted. Beijing dug in, and a tense standoff ensued. The umbrella became a symbol of resistance. In addition to protecting against the rain, it could be a shield against tear gas and pepper spray, or the watchful eye of surveillance. In November 2014, at the height of the umbrella movement, I traveled to Beijing with President Obama. The focus of the trip was securing an ambitious Chinese pledge to combat climate change. If the United States and China could make a joint announcement about their commitments to slow global warming, the rest of the world could be brought along to achieve what would end up as the Paris Agreement. Hong Kong was in the backdrop, the latest human rights irritant in our relationship with the Chinese government, and therefore something Obama would raise in his meeting with Xi. To the American media, there was additional drama revolving around whether Xi Jinping would take questions from the press alongside Obama. In this way, issues related to human rights are reduced to a kind of formulaic play. The U.S. government raises issues privately with little expectation that they will be resolved to our liking. The U.S. media champion issues related to press freedom that are also about whether they get to ask Xi Jinping a question. We Americans get to perform on behalf of human rights, but when we leave, nothing changes. Obama took a private walk with Xi, the kind of time alone when you can make a hard ask on a sensitive matter. Obama pressed Xi to raise the ambition of China's climate pledge. He succeeded in that effort. It is hard for me not to see the logic of the trade-off in prioritizing climate change over Hong Kong rights in that kind of setting. Without China, it was impossible to achieve a global agreement to fight climate change. Saving the planet seemed like even more of a progressive priority than the umbrella movement. Perhaps more acutely, there was little evidence that pressing Xi harder personally on Hong Kong would make any difference. The Chinese routinely reject criticism of what they deem internal matters. There have been trade-offs like this for decades. At every turn, there is some competing priority that makes complete sense in the moment, just as it can seem pointless to press the Chinese Communist Party to move in a direction that they will surely resist. But the problem for people like me is being part of a broader enterprise that has allowed itself, over time, to see human rights as a secondary or even unattainable objective. That's what the U.S. government, as well as American society writ large, has done with China since Tiananmen. Obama did raise the Hong Kong question in his larger bilateral meeting. Xi was predictably dismissive, blaming the protests on a small group of troublemakers and saying it was an internal matter for China. Obama argued that respecting the right to protest and addressing the concerns of the movement would ultimately bring more stability than repressive measures. But Xi was clearly uninterested in debating these points. Afterward, Xi did agree to take questions at a press conference, which earned us goodwill with our media. In the press conference, Xi confidently announced, "In my talks with President Obama, I also pointed out that Occupy Central is an illegal movement in Hong Kong. We are firmly supportive of the efforts of the Hong Kong Special Administrative Region government to handle the situation according to the law, so as to maintain social stability in Hong Kong and protect the life and the property of the Hong Kong residents. Hong Kong affairs are exclusively China's internal affairs, and foreign countries should not interfere in those affairs in any form or fashion." This statement was strikingly similar to what Xi said in private. Obama noted that America was not behind the movement in Hong Kong. "The United States," he said, "as a matter of foreign policy, but also a matter of our values, is going to consistently speak out on the right of people to express themselves and encourage the elections that take place in Hong Kong are transparent and fair and reflective of the opinions of people there." From my seat in one of the front rows, the tableau of the U.S. and Chinese leaders looked like a familiar production. Even as this unusual movement had taken hold in Hong Kong, it was aimed at capturing their attention and the attention of the world. I watched as Xi was asked a question by The People's Daily, a state-run newspaper. "As China further develops, how does China see its own position in international affairs?" As if to emphasize the extent to which the whole thing was a charade, Xi quite obviously read an answer that had been prepared for that particular question in advance, as colorless as a progress report at a Politburo meeting. At the banquet lunch that followed, the Chinese seated me next to an affable older man who had been Hong Kong's first chief executive after the handover. The Chinese do their homework. Presumably, they knew that I would be one of the staffers most likely to press Obama to be outspoken on Hong Kong, and that I would be asked about it by the media myself. The man smilingly explained that the vast majority of people in Hong Kong did not support the umbrella movement because of their good feelings for China and their desire to get back to normal. I noted that to Americans, the movement seemed to reflect fairly obvious concerns among the people of Hong Kong, particularly young people. "It will all be over soon," he told me, smiling. It was over soon. Beijing and the Hong Kong authorities waited out the umbrella movement. After 79 days, the protesters had to go back to work, and the leaders of the movement were arrested. The election remained within Beijing's control. The message was clear. Time was on the side of the Chinese Communist Party, which could treat a social movement like a minor speed bump in its assertion of control over Hong Kong. Around the same time, the Hong Kong booksellers were detained and taken to China. "These guys were not prominent activists," Wilson told me. "I don't even know if they can be called dissidents, because they're just publishing things. They're not writing." What unsettled people, he said, was how random the detentions were. One bookseller was taken from Hong Kong, another from Thailand, suggesting a lack of safety anywhere, foreshadowing the extradition law. "The most shocking thing is that it was not shocking," he told me. "The most shocking thing is that it was not shocking." It was a sentence that had become like a reflex to me during the Trump presidency. To Wilson, the lack of popular resistance in Hong Kong was just as disturbing as the actions being taken by Beijing. The pro-democracy movement spoke up, but not the rest of society. A lot of them, he remembered, were silent. This fact is central to understanding the success of China's model of control. Fear silences people as much as any particular governmental dictate. There's self-censorship, Wilson told me. In these semi-authoritarian or authoritarian regimes, they're very good at shutting down people from saying anything that might be quote-unquote political. And in that context, political usually means something that's critical of the government. On mainland China, there are very lively debates on many issues, but nothing that would touch the government. You know, as soon as someone tries to say something in the chat room about the government, everyone falls silent because everyone knows that you don't go there. Self-censorship had become a prominent feature of life in Hong Kong. If you want to get ahead in politics, don't criticize the Chinese government. If you want to get ahead in business, don't criticize the Chinese government. Even without a social credit system in place, the effect is already present. Wilson pointed out a different, more social form of self-censorship. Authoritarian regimes are very good at equating political with bad, he said. So if anyone's a political person, that means they're some kind of devious or bad person. So you always get the message from the pro-Beijing camp: keep politics off campus. But what they actually mean is don't have students who oppose the government. They're fine with students who praise Beijing and praise One Belt, One Road and so on, but they're not fine with students who support democracy. This reminded me of Marta Pardavi in Budapest, watching potential donors to her civil society organization opt for the ballet instead. Or in America, the warnings I got at times to tone down my anti-Trump commentary for fear of appearing hysterical, unserious. I think, Wilson told me, this feeds into the general atmosphere of society where you think, I better not say anything. And then there's the element, which might even be common with the U.S., where you just don't want to get into it. Wilson decided to become political despite the risks. In the wake of the Umbrella Movement, he helped form the Progressive Lawyers Group. Many lawyers in Hong Kong were reluctant to pick fights with China because their firms had business there. As an independent lawyer, Wilson didn't have the same constraint. I wondered, as I talked to him, whether someone was watching, just as I'd wondered whether my communications were being monitored. So I asked about his decision to become political. "You either have to stay silent or have to come out," he told me. "Once you have spoken out," he said, "you're kind of too late, you know? So, for example, our group was named in pro-Beijing newspapers as some diehard opposition group. Once you're on that list, you're stuck." For a few years after the Umbrella Movement, things settled back into a new kind of status quo. Carrie Lam, a nondescript, pre-screened, pro-Beijing politician, was elected chief executive in 2017. Then, in early 2019, her government introduced the extradition law. Basically, it felt as if anyone could end up like those booksellers. People took to the streets. "It's very easy for people to understand," Wilson told me. "The simple idea that you'll be taken over the border." This time, the protest united the city. This included the more traditional Democrats who think of Hong Kong as part of China, but want what was promised under One Country, Two Systems, and what Wilson called localists, who emphasized the preservation of Hong Kong identity. Beyond that, there was an assortment of students, religious groups, chambers of commerce, business people, and those who had been squeezed by Hong Kong's booming real estate prices. The marches were small at first. Most people believed the bill would just be rammed through the Hong Kong legislature. But in June 2019, more than a million people turned out in the streets. "There was a recognition that we have to be united," Wilson said, referring to the scale. "We can't afford division because we're already in a much weaker position. And it's even worse if you argue among yourselves about tactics." He cited one of the movement's slogans. "We each climb the mountain, each in our own way." The movement learned from the failure of the umbrella movement. Because people can't take off work for months at a time, this time the protest would be episodic. A flash mob on a lunch break, a surge of people on a weekend in shifting locations. Because an identified leadership could be arrested, this time there was no leadership. Instead, a kind of direct democracy prevailed. In some cases, protesters went into mass groups on encrypted online message boards and voted on a time and place for protest. This is how the movement tried to avoid being crushed by Beijing, like a virus evolving to survive. No disunity, no single venue, no leader, secure communication. Over the summer of 2019, the authorities started blocking peaceful mass protest. In this second phase of the protest, the police set up roadblocks and clashed with protesters who turned out. Many people who'd participated in the mass marches started staying home, and the streets were left to what became known as frontline protesters, people who chose to climb the mountain through confrontation. As the protest stubbornly continued every day, with crowds that swelled on the weekends, the approach toughened. "They started shutting it down as soon as people appeared in the streets," Wilson told me, "firing tear gas and so on." Wilson and I were surrounded by the trappings of a prosperity unknown in most of the world. A shopping mall filled with designer stores, the brand names inseparable from the 1% that had been the subject of the first Occupy protest on Wall Street. Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany. The prosperity itself was suffocating. The promise that you could aspire to buy these things if you just shut up and stayed home. I think there's little illusion as to how ruthless the government, the CCP, is in keeping control, Wilson said. People here can see what they do in Xinjiang, what they do in Tibet, where there's a whole system of society set up to monitor, control what you do, and also to erase your separate identity. While this upscale shopping mall could feel a million miles from the unseen lands of Western China to an American like me, it didn't to Wilson. "I think that's certainly something that weighs on people's minds here, that some of the things that they do in Xinjiang could come to Hong Kong as well." I asked Wilson what the people of Hong Kong wanted. He gave a simple answer: to be left alone. It was a less ambitious definition of freedom. To be left alone. One country, two systems. You're pretty much left to do what you want, say what you want, educate your people in the way you want. You can criticize China in the same way as you can criticize the Queen or the Prime Minister if you're in Scotland. Summing it up, he said, your separate system and separate identity are respected. This feeling, he noted, was overwhelming among the youth. 19. The narrative of liberalism and democracy collapsed. November 24, 2019 was Election Day in Hong Kong. The elections were for district councils, local bodies whose power was limited and focused on concerns like trash collection and traffic patterns. But the district councils are the only fully democratically elected political institutions in the city. So their election every 4 years represents a clear barometer of public opinion. The protest movement hoped they could send a message, even if only symbolic, at the ballot box. The authorities wanted to convey a sense of normality and hoped to use the election to take some steam out of the protests. Therefore, a truce of sorts had been called. This would be the first weekend in many months without a protest. The remaining flashpoint was a protracted standoff at the Hong Kong Polytechnic University, which had been cordoned off as police laid siege to a few dozen remaining protesters, armed with Molotov cocktails and makeshift bows and arrows. When I first got to Hong Kong, someone pointed out plumes of smoke coming from the university across the river, silent in the distant sky. Before going to see some polling sites, I met in the lounge of the hotel with an official from the Hong Kong government, a body with significantly more power than the district council, but less than the colossus of the Communist Party to the north. He wished to remain anonymous. Even though it was on a weekend, he was neatly dressed with carefully combed hair, a man who exuded the care and dignity of a technocrat who tried to do the best he could, even if he couldn't control the circumstances that shaped his work. His thoughts were already carefully prepared when I told him that I was trying to understand the ascendant authoritarianism and nationalism in the world and how they connected to what was happening in Hong Kong. "The nationalism in the U.S. and Europe is somewhat different," he told me. "Yours started with the financial crisis in 2008. That's when liberalism started to lose its appeal, when people saw this isn't working. The narrative of liberalism and democracy collapsed. This spilled over into China, too. This is when China started to think, should we really follow a Western model? Look what's happened. That's when you start to hear more about a Chinese model. So the nationalism movements in East and West were both a response to the collapse of the Western model." He had basically summed up in a few sentences what I'd been wrestling with for 2 years. Yet I'd come to realize that this was only the surface level of what was happening. Underneath, there was the question of how people everywhere were adjusting to this shift toward nationalism or resisting it. Those questions of identity that were supplanting the ideological debates of the last century. And the tectonic plates of geopolitics seemed to run right under Hong Kong, a city where the last 25 years has seen expectations upended, with consequences looming for every Hong Konger. "My generation is more sympathetic to China," the official told me, explaining his feelings about the 1997 handover. In the early years of Chinese rule, he said, many people like him had made excuses for China's repression on the mainland. "China has been divided and kept down by the West, so it has to be wary. China is very poor, so it has to cut corners on the path to development." Still, there was also an expectation that Hong Kong would be largely left alone by Beijing. "Hong Kong was valuable to China, and it was in their interest to maintain a high degree of autonomy," he explained. Hong Kong, after all, was an international financial capital that could be a gateway for investment into China, a capitalist bridge between a communist country that was opening up and the world that wanted access to China's market. If the price of having that gateway was an open society in Hong Kong, where Westerners could be comfortable living and the locals govern themselves, China would see that as a price worth paying. For that first decade after the handover, it felt to the official like China and Hong Kong were proceeding comfortably on parallel tracks. One country, two systems. "But after 2008, he said, "we thought we are no longer on the same track." He briefly sketched how a more prosperous China became more assertive over the last decade. More mainlanders started moving to Hong Kong, speaking Mandarin instead of Cantonese. The government started to try to change the curriculum in Hong Kong schools to mandate propaganda that celebrated the Communist Party. The media was increasingly bought up by those pro-mainland tycoons Wilson talked to me about. Particularly after Xi Jinping came to power, governance became more top-down, and Beijing's liaison office in Hong Kong, its official representation in the city, became more aggressive on the issues that it cared about. This whole time, the official had served in Hong Kong's government. On the surface, he said, some things were the same, when it came to issues like transportation, housing, and other local issues. Most of the time, they don't give a shit, he said, referring to Beijing. It's how to deal with politics. That's when the Chinese government came in. This could be seen, for instance, in the selection of Hong Kong's chief executive and the way that some members of the legislature were backed by powerful Chinese interests. Their guys win elections. That's the measure of their performance. If you wanted to get ahead, you had to toe the Beijing line. The liaison office began to perform the role of the whip in Hong Kong's legislature, bringing pressure to bear to make sure important votes went Beijing's way. This created the precarious state that the Hong Kong government found itself in by 2019. Anger has been building for many years, he told me. When the extradition bill was introduced, it was like a bomb. I asked him how a bill like this gets proposed by a government that knows it will be unpopular. Ostensibly, the reason had been a murder case. A Hong Kong resident had killed his pregnant girlfriend in Taiwan before returning to Hong Kong, and the authorities wanted to be able to extradite him to Taiwan. Despite the fact that Taiwan is not governed by China, the government argued that the right to extradite someone to Taiwan would enable extradition to mainland China as well. Beyond this individual case, the broader political objective, erasing the lines between China and Hong Kong, was obvious. It's a feeling of kill two birds with one stone, the official said. He told me that Beijing didn't order the Hong Kong government to introduce the extradition bill. Instead, they had simply made it known that there were a bunch of measures that they expected to see enacted over a period of time, including the extradition bill. You deal with this one murder case, and you check this one item off the list. The timing was up to the Hong Kong government, but the message was clear. You do what you can to get ahead, he said. And the way to get ahead, to bolster your social credit score, so to speak, was to do what the Chinese Communist Party wanted. A wan smile crept across the official's face as he recalled with nostalgia Barack Obama's election in 2008 and how he had inspired people across the political spectrum in Hong Kong. I had the familiar feeling of sitting in silence with someone remembering that hopeful moment, even as the die of the financial crisis that the official had spoken about had already been cast. He explained that Obama was the kind of inspirational figure who couldn't exist in Hong Kong. You have to understand, he told me, one of the legacies of colonialism is that we do not have good politicians. For that reason, the protest movement didn't have a clear sense of direction. Surprisingly, he said something similar about Beijing. China may not have an overall plan, he told me. Their approach is the hard approach, and then you have to stick with it. For the rest of the day, I wandered the city from polling site to polling site. For a place that had been rocked by upheaval, the scenes were quiet and orderly. Huge lines formed. Families stood together. People snapped selfies. Nobody appeared impatient, even though some lines went on for hours. One young voter told me he lived in the UK, but had flown back home so that he could participate. There were many others like him, he said. I was reluctant to linger too long at any one location, mindful of the propaganda point about foreign interference. I came to one of the main train stations that connected the city by rail to the airport, where demonstrators had proved earlier that fall that they could grind air traffic to a halt. There had been an impact on Hong Kong's economy from the protests. Fewer mainlanders coming to shop, more international conferences relocated to Singapore, contingency plans for banks to move some of their employees there as well. But in the train station, the shops were immaculately lit and an orderly procession of Hong Kongers passed through infrastructure that would make Americans envious. This was the promise of wealth, order, and connectivity to the world that was supposed to be the allure of being swallowed within China's political boundaries and accepting the story of the Communist Party's steady ascent. Back outside, the high-rise apartment buildings hinted at the limits of that promise. Many young Hong Kongers can't afford the housing prices, which have been driven up by the influx of mainland Chinese tycoons and the continued presence of foreigners. Some work all day and spend their nights cocooned in small rooms along with others. the wealth on display is out of reach. The reward is a small piece of a small room and the ability to feel that you are a part of a greater whole. If the American dream, in economic terms, is embodied by visionaries who upend a status quo, the Chinese dream is embodied by those who don't. Perhaps, with the right mix of hard work and fealty to the party, you could rise like the Chinese nation, could achieve the Chinese dream. Earnest campaign workers handed out flyers for their preferred candidates. You could tell the progressives by their youth, people still in their early 20s, as young as I had been on that ferry back in 2002. I took their leaflets and smiled back, thinking that it could be both their first and last experience of a free election. I met with two young men who were active in the protests. I'll call them Adam and David. They were both in their 20s and not out of place in the somewhat upscale bar where we ordered drinks that sat largely untouched on a white-clothed table. David, a so-called frontline protester, spoke differently from the others I'd met in Hong Kong. His own identity seemed immersed in the movement in a way that even Wilson Long's wasn't. For the last 6 months, he'd gone out once or twice each week. He was at the airport when protesters clashed with the authorities. He wore black masks. He'd taken part in strikes. He'd joined human chains against police in the streets. He'd been tear gassed. He spoke with a dispassionate tone. This was a matter of logistics and tactics. The necessity of participation was obvious. The movement would likely fail, but that didn't matter. The protests were as much an end as a means. At the beginning, David and Adam said, it could take 3 to 4 days to set up a protest. Now it was much faster. There are different online forums for different protests. Someone proposes a location, and whatever gets the most likes becomes the protest site. A phone was handed to me. In just one Telegram group, I saw there were 288,419 people. New comments flashed in Chinese characters, a living organism that never stopped growing online. Sometimes, the decision-making was driven by events. People see protesters getting beaten up by police, and people organize another protest, and so it goes. Adam told me a story about how a young protester was shot recently, and within hours, there was a flash mob. The details of the event were discussed and agreed to online with urgent efficiency. We're going to have a candlelight vigil. It's not going to be violent. We're going to be silent. Adam referred to the be-water ethos of the movement, modeled on Bruce Lee's view of Kung Fu, Eastern philosophy expropriated through a Hollywood lens. Anonymity, flexibility, and spontaneity, giving them an advantage over police who use more formal tactics in organization. A whole genre of songs, slogans, and artwork had emerged about and around the protests, content also shared online. A culture grew up around a movement gone viral. After summer break, Adam said, the government thought a return to school would stop the protests, but the opposite happened. Students coming back together only added to the momentum as they returned to classrooms eager to participate in this shared identity picked up over the summer. Everyone in the city who supported the protest contributed what they could. Some people sewed clothes. Others bought bottles of water and set up supply stations behind the protest areas. Others, like the Progressive Lawyers Group, offered professional expertise. The leaders of the umbrella movement, who had reputations in other countries, served as diplomats on behalf of the movement. There was an implicit understanding that different people would go to different lengths, and that was okay. They know I go to protests, David said of friends and family. I know a friend who has gas masks. We don't discuss it. David gave me an example of how this unspoken ethos worked. There had recently been a protest near Hong Kong's Legislative Council. The police responded with tear gas and water cannons. A canister of tear gas landed right next to David's leg. He ran away with a group of people, but barricades and lines of police blocked their escape. Everyone in his group was wearing a black mask, a sign of a frontline protester. Shops that were closed, owned by people who were losing business because of the protests, and may well have disagreed with the tactics used by people who wore masks, opened their doors to let the protesters avoid capture. They closed their gates and covered their windows. David and his friends slipped into the lobby of an upscale hotel where they were also quietly welcomed. A friend of his fainted from the tear gas exposure and was tended to. They were allowed to pretend to be customers and left unmolested. In this way, the city had become a place of safe houses and collaborators. I asked about the masks in particular. The authorities had tried to ban them. Was it about concealing identity? It's about being in defiance, David told me. In Singapore, I'd heard an allegation that had the ring of Chinese propaganda, that crates of masks had been shipped into Hong Kong, paid for by rich Taiwanese, aided by the CIA. How do you get the masks? I asked. Amazon, he replied. A brief debate broke out about whether the protest needed a leader, someone who could make decisions, negotiate with the authorities. Adam thought the recent standoffs at universities suggested this was necessary, as students trapped behind the barricades struggled to escape. There was also the larger matter of how to define success. The so-called five demands of the protesters represented the clearest statement of objectives. Those five demands were permanent withdrawal of the extradition bill, a call on the authorities to characterize the demonstrations as protests and not riots, accountability for police violence, the release and exoneration of all protesters detained, and universal suffrage for the people of Hong Kong. The demands were clear, but most of them were about the protests themselves. Only the last one began to define a future for Hong Kong. The demands emanated from the banner of Marco Leung, a protester who jumped to his death from the roof of a shopping mall in the center of the city. Some frontline protesters carried suicide notes with protest demands. Others carried notes indicating that they had not committed suicide in the event that they were killed by the authorities. There's a dark term used when authorities kill someone and call it a suicide. The person is said to be suicided. This idea of individuals carrying notes offered a vivid image. To me, the entire city seemed to carry within it a message in a bottle, cast out to the wider world before Hong Kong was swallowed up. I asked David if he carried a note, and he said no. But with a sly smile, he said that he had programmed an out-of-office message for his work email account that would activate if he was gone for a certain period of time, notifying the sender that he'd been detained by the authorities. I don't think there's a strategy, Adam said of the movement. It's a collective of everyone's anger and vision and depression. Within the system, nothing will make a difference. The suggestion was that the protest could at least carve out a temporary space outside the system, a place of refuge for a population who increasingly felt like outsiders in their own city. I understand the reasons behind the violence, David said. We have tried peaceful protest many times, but the government didn't respond. The impulse to fight back became more acute when it was clear that there was no accountability for police abuses. The police didn't even help injured protesters on the streets. One time, an angry taxi driver plowed into a crowd and ran over a girl whose leg was later amputated. The taxi driver was not charged. There were plenty of stories like this going around, fueling the defiance. The protesters faced a multi-headed opponent that was entrenched and complex. Hong Kong's notorious organized criminal syndicates sided with the government and attacked protesters in their own flash mobs, instigating violence that the authorities wanted so they could cast the protests as riots. The Chinese state-owned and party-friendly media then portrayed the protesters as violent rioters, wearing down public opinion in Hong Kong and abroad by invoking the hundreds of billions of dollars at stake for the city's private sector and the inevitable strings that Beijing could pull in the Hong Kong government. "We don't know all that is happening behind the scenes," Adam said, particularly with regard to the relationship between the government and various powerful business interests. I asked about the economic drivers of the protest, the frustration over inequality, over the lack of housing. To David and Adam, those were indistinguishable from questions about democracy. "The system is structured to favor certain groups," they said, "including mainland Chinese interests and those who back them." In the end, the protests were about something bigger than a rigged system, bigger even than democracy. "Hong Kong identity has been created during this movement," David told me. As powerful as that idea was, a community of people who had forged a new identity in opposition to authority, there was still the seeming impossibility of defining what success looks like for a Hong Kong that is, after all, still a part of China. Can a distinct Hong Kong identity be preserved? Or would China itself have to change in order for Hong Kongers to have their own identity? And how long would that take? "It does scare the shit out of me," Adam said, referring to a future in which Hong Kong has been fully swallowed up by China. The idea of one country, two systems rendered an eccentric historical footnote. "If we don't win this movement, it could be in a few years, it could be now, it could be in 2047. It will happen. When we look at Xinjiang, this dystopia is happening to millions of people. I don't want people to go through that." Adam was composed, intelligent, articulate, the kind of person who would likely succeed at whatever he chooses to do. He was deeply invested in the movement, yet over the course of our conversation, I couldn't help but notice contradictions between his awe at what the protests had accomplished and his awareness that they hadn't changed any of the fundamentals at work, between his belief in the world as it should be and his recognition of the world as it is. For David, these contradictions were beside the point. The rightness of the movement was all that mattered. He said, matter-of-factly, that he understood he might end up getting imprisoned. "I'm prepared for it. I will not think what I've done is wrong." What was also clear is how much the movement was about more than just democracy. It was about Hong Kong identity. In the act of protest, this identity had been forged. A community had come together through their recognition of where things were going, and they had found themselves in their effort to stop it. Through that action, they discovered the extent of their own agency in the world and its limits. But they'd also discovered who they were, and that couldn't be taken away. In a world increasingly defined by identity politics, Hong Kong raised distinct questions. What does it mean to be a Hong Konger in a place that was passed from colonial British rule to the Chinese Communist Party? If your ethnicity aligns with the very power that is encroaching on your sense of identity, how do you think of yourself? If your identity is in opposition to the forces steadily swallowing up your community, what do you do with it? To get at these questions, I wanted to meet young people who weren't particularly active in politics, but were struggling to make sense of it all. I reached out to a friend named John, a perpetually sunny millennial who prided himself on knowing people across Hong Kong's political spectrum. One afternoon, we went to a local bar and met with two young people named Charles and Lorraine, both around 30 years old. The sound system churned out a steady stream of American rock hits from the 1980s, the music of my childhood, the dusk of the Cold War, the long tail of American influence. Def Leppard's Pour Some Sugar on Me and Journey's Don't Stop Believin'. I asked them to go back to the handover to give me a sense of how things had changed. Lorraine explained what one country, two systems meant by quoting a Chinese proverb famously used by the former Chinese Communist Party leader Jiang Zemin. "The river water does not intrude into the well water." For her, as a child, the change in sovereignty had been almost imperceptible. She started to learn more about China in school, and that was about it. many people were proud of their Chinese identity and the end of colonialism. By 2012, she said, things had changed. Lorraine remembered being contacted